May the words of my lips and the meditations of our hearts be at all times acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our Rock and our Redeemer. We pray that we may hear your voice today, O God, that your Spirit will be present with us, and that in all we do and say we may be directed in the fulfilling of your purposes. In Jesus' name, amen. So my name's Chris. This is my first time here. And as I said, thank you for the kind invitation. I'm an Anglican priest by trade. And over the next couple of weeks, you're going to get to see Anglicanism, or in particular, the Church of England, doing its thing. The Church of England and the Anglican Communion is the Department of Religion of the British Empire, where the chaplains to the colonising project. And we are the kind of enforcers and apologists of status and hierarchy. That is the great gift of Anglicanism to the world. And you'll get to see that in full flight all over your televisions for the next couple of weeks. But the other great gift of Anglicanism, and perhaps the reason why I've stuck with it, is the parish system. The parish system in the Church of England and in the Anglican Communion more generally, which sort of covers nearly the whole globe, says that everyone within the parish bounds belongs. Everyone matters. Everyone has a place. Whether you attend church, whether you've never darkened the doors, whether you're a Christian or not, whatever you are, you know, you are important and we are here to serve you. And it's that bit of Anglicanism that keeps me just barely by the skin of my teeth inside the Worldwide Anglican Communion. Until the start of this year, I was a parish priest up in the hills in Darlington, and I'm now on the loose. So I've still, as I say, I've still got the magic. I can still do all the magic bits, but I don't have a parish of my own. But actually, I live in your patch. I live in Tuart Hill. So it's great to have a very short drive to church this morning. Exodus chapter 2 we heard read to us, and the kind of theme today is midwives of life and liberation. I'm going to talk a bit about Exodus chapter 2 and about what's going on in there, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the current work that I'm doing to myself try to be a midwife of life and liberation, and that is through Faith Workers Alliance, which is a new national interfaith union for people who work as faith workers in a professional capacity. But let's begin with the text, and in particular, let's begin with the people in the text. So at the start of Exodus, a new Pharaoh has come to power and is feeling threatened. Can you imagine that? A new man comes to power and feels threatened by what's going on. Wouldn't happen today. But he has these Israelites, you know, who have been there for a long time. Remember, it was Joseph with the coat who brought the Israelites over during the Great Famine. The Israelites have been there for a long time, and Pharaoh's feeling threatened by the Israelites, and so comes up with a cunning scheme to decrease the number of Israelites and to decrease their influence. And so he says, if a girl Israelite child is born, she shall live, but if a boy Israelite child is born, then the midwives are to murder the child as it is born. Now, my sister-in-law is a midwife. Some of you might have been midwives or nurses of some kind. And I'd just like you to imagine for a moment what it must be like for someone whose job it is, whose vocation it is, to bring life into the world, to be given an instruction that upon this life coming into the world, you are to immediately extinguish that life. Not only is it a life coming to the world, but it's the life of your own people, your own tribe, your own family, effectively, recognising that the Israelites were a group of people who identified a bit like perhaps like an Aboriginal nation today. Everyone's related to everyone else. So your job is to bring the life into the world momentarily and then kill it. That's an extraordinary, audacious thing to ask someone to do. And we meet these two women, Shifra and Puah, who are the midwives who are for the Israelite people, who are given this instruction by Pharaoh. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never been to a St. Shifra's or a St. Puah's church anywhere in the world. I have never, I've never celebrated St. Shifra's Day or St. Puah's Day. I've never met a child called Shifra or Puah. I didn't really learn their names. I remember the story vaguely because I actually went to Sunday school back when we had such things. I remember the story, but I don't remember learning their names. Did you? No. And yet these iconic women, without them, we have no story of our faith. We have no salvation narrative. There is no Moses. There is no Exodus. There is no promised land. There is no Ten Commandments. None of that happens without Shipra and Pua. These are the midwives. I call them the midwives of life and liberation. I didn't make that up. That's from a book I read. But the midwives of life and liberation. These are the women who dare to say no. But the great thing about the way they say no is that they don't put themselves at risk by going to Pharaoh and saying, oh, you know that instruction you gave, O great and mighty king? No, we're not going to do that. What they say instead is that, oh, Pharaoh, they say, those Israelite women, they just give birth so quickly. We can't get to them in time. No sooner have we heard that there's a baby coming and out pops a baby from an Israelite woman. Now, it's possible that Pharaoh had very little experience of how women give birth, even amongst the Egyptian women. In fact, it's entirely possible that men generally have very little knowledge about how women give birth, even today. I've never been present at a birth, and my father wasn't present at my birth. It was frowned upon for the man. The man was a nuisance. He was to get out of the way. Things have changed a little bit since then. So Pharaoh doesn't really get how the birthing process works, perhaps, at the best of times, but he believes the lie. He believes the lie that the Israelite women give birth so quickly that the midwives can't get to them in time in order to murder the babies. Let's just emphasize here that Shifra and Pua lie, brazenly lie. In fact, they tell a lie so absurd, so ridiculous, that Pharaoh evidently believes it. He's like, nobody could make up something so ridiculous that he accepts that it's the truth. So Pharaoh comes up with an alternative. Pharaoh says, all right. Well, clearly the midwives can't be relied upon to get there in time to assassinate the babies as soon as they pop out of their mothers. So what we need you to do is, as soon as a baby boy is born, chuck him into the Nile. Straightforward, right? Because only a king could come up with that kind of instruction, because a mother only has to overcome all of her natural instincts in order to kill her own child, right? This all makes perfect sense to Pharaoh, evidently. So we meet Jochebed. That's the name that the Talmud gives to Moses' mother. It's not in the scriptures, but it's a name attributed to her by tradition. So Jochebed has given birth. She knows that the instruction from Pharaoh is to chuck her newborn baby into the River Nile. But she doesn't. What she does is she hides the baby. Ever hidden a baby? Just think about it for a moment. Imagine trying to hide a baby. Imagine, too, you don't live in nice brick buildings with, you know, windows that close and all of that. You're living in simple dwellings. Hide a baby? Now, what is the only conceivable way that you can hide a baby in those circumstances if everyone's in on it? Everyone knows that Jochebed's got a newborn. They've seen her for 9 months getting bigger. They clearly know she's given birth. And then she hides the baby, and everyone's like, no, I'm not. I didn't hear anything. I didn't notice anything going on with this baby. Everyone, the whole of the tribal group conspires effectively to keep the baby hidden. And one has to wonder, was this in fact the normal practice? Did they conspire with every baby? Was there a system? Were they trying to get babies away, you know, baby boys away to some other location? Was there, who knows? But everyone participated in this act of defiance. Everyone had a role, but particularly Jochebed, Moses' mother, the courage required to breach the law, the risks that she was taking, and the reality that if she was caught, she would surely face certain death, as would her child, but she does it anyway. Finally, after 3 months, Jochebed reaches the point where she can't hide this baby any longer. So she prepares, and you know the story from papyrus or bulrushes, she prepares a little bed and covers it in pitch and tar so that it's watertight and it can float down the River Nile. And Miriam, who is Moses' big sister, is watching all this from a distance. Now, in the text, it's portrayed as though this is all kind of circumstantial, as if this is all almost by accident. I suspect, though, if we look at how the world operates, was Jochebed really just abandoning her child to the Nile, never to be seen again? And was Miriam just standing away off in the distance watching just out of sort of morbid interest to see what's going to happen to her baby brother? I suspect there was a plan afoot, because who should come wandering along very shortly after but the princess herself, Pharaoh's daughter, who's another woman whose name we don't know, and her attendants. They all come tootling along by the banks of the Nile, and who do they come upon but little baby Moses in the little boat? And they look in, and Pharaoh's daughter, who's presumably not a fool, looks in and she sees the baby. Now, I'm not a baby expert, but I think there's a difference between a newborn baby and a three-month-old baby. They're quite different. And a woman knows the difference between a newborn and a three-month-old. As soon as Pharaoh's daughter looked into the face of this little baby, she knew that it hadn't just been born. She knew someone had been hiding this baby for some time, and she knew, presumably by looking at the baby and because of its location, that it was an Israelite child. She knew immediately that something was amiss, and she had to make a decision in that moment what to do about this illegal baby that she had stumbled across. But fortunately, she wasn't alone in this moment, because who should wobble along but Miriam, who says, "Oh, hello, princess. What's this? A baby. What shall we do? Oh, such a difficult challenge here. Oh no. The baby will need milk. How will the baby get milk? Maybe I could find somebody who has milk who could feed the baby." And Miriam goes, "Where could I find such a person?" It's like a pantomime. "Where can I find such a person?" And people are shouting, "Behind you! Behind you!" She goes, "Oh, here's one I prepared earlier. Perhaps this woman could nurse the baby for you." Now, do you think that the princess of the Egyptians, Pharaoh's daughter, she's a political operative. Do you think she's that dumb that she doesn't know what's going on? Of course she knows what's going on. And she says, "This is a great little conspiracy. I might just go along with that. I might help this child to live." And you know how the story unfolds, that Moses ultimately grows up in the royal court, and then, you know, plagues, Exodus, you know, all of that happens afterwards. But none of that story happens without these five women who are the midwives, collectively the midwives of life and liberation. And I want to suggest to you that these women, each of them, are a kind of an archetype or a model for each of us in how we might also be midwives of life and liberation. And that each one of them, in the way they operate in that scenario, is a kind of a form of, like, someone we can look at as an example of holy change-making. I come from the perspective that all of us have an obligation, a Christian obligation that arises out of our faith, to get involved in holy change-making. When I get to know groups of people better, I change it to holy troublemaking. But we've just met, so we're going to call it change-making today. But it's really, it's troublemaking. It's the ministry of troublemaking. And so we often talk about being pastoral or being a community in church, and we are those things and we should be those things. But another outworking of being relational, of being connected to one another, in being in solidarity with one another, is that we not only care for those within our group, but that we also get involved in troublemaking beyond our immediate group or tribe. So some of the roles in holy change making, and you'll see some of the photos I'm using here are from the Love Makes a Way era when various of us were working to get children out of immigration detention centres. So the midwives. The midwives were calm and resolute in the face of injustice. They were told, go, murder babies. And they, instead of panicking and falling apart, they came up with a plan to both protect themselves and to protect the children. They are quietly defiant. They don't get up all in a Pharaoh's face and say, you know where you can shove that? I will never kill any babies. They just didn't kill any babies. And they found a way to do it without having to get into conflict directly with Pharaoh. But they are willing to do whatever it takes in order to protect others. They did put themselves at risk, and they did do what was necessary. And they have a healthy sense of the absurd. One of the things I've learned over years of troublemaking and change making is that you have to be able to laugh about how ridiculous things are. I was just reflecting on it yesterday. One of the funniest experiences of my life was that I and another Church of Christ minister and I were tailing a car, which sounds very dramatic. It was the immigration detention centre in Northam was transporting a guy who was going to be put on a plane and flown back to Sri Lanka, and he was going into imminent danger. And we had intelligence. We knew about this. And we had someone on the inside. So we managed, and there's only one entry and exit, which made it easier. So we were tailing a vehicle from Northam into Perth Airport. And They ran the plates because it was Serco, but they're in touch with the cops. They ran the plates and it comes up and says, oh, who owns the vehicle? Churches of Christ WA. They were very confused by that. So anyway, we tailed the vehicle and long story, we didn't manage to stop the deportation, sadly, but the federal police then said that we were under arrest. They pulled us over and said we were under arrest. And we said, oh, that's very serious. What charge? And they said, oh, we haven't decided yet. But I was told to get into the back of the wagon, the federal police wagon, but the ladder was about this far off the ground. Now, I can't get up that high. Like, I needed more steps on the ladder. And I'm like, look, I'm really sorry, but I can't climb this ladder. I can't get up into the car because they don't often put people in the back of federal police vans. And the police was like, you have to do it. I'm like, no, I physically cannot do this. I'm happy to ride in the front. Would you like to handcuff me so that you'll feel safe when we ride in the front? He got very angry and upset. You have to have a sense of the absurd in these situations. When we get involved in change-making or troublemaking, sometimes it's easy to leave our sense of humour behind. But actually, I have found that the reverse is true, that we have to be able to laugh often at how ridiculous and absurd situations are, particularly situations of injustice. Jochebed, who's the mother in this situation, was a quiet planner. Quiet planners are invaluable when it comes to change-making and troublemaking. She had 9 months or so to plan. How was she going to hide the baby? What was she going to do? Who did she need to coach? Who did she need to talk to? She was thinking several steps ahead. If it's the case, as I propose, that she and Miriam hatched this plan to put the baby in front of Pharaoh's daughter, well, that required some planning. She needed to know the schedule. She needed to collect intelligence. And she had the gift of avoiding attention. One of the most useful ways that people can effect change is by just going about their business, collecting information, influencing and making a difference. Sometimes we imagine that change is effected by large-scale rallies and, you know, chaining ourselves to bulldozers, and all of that has a place. And if you'd like to be chained to a bulldozer, please let me know after. I can put you in touch with the right people. But there's also something to be said for the covert change maker. And over the years, in a range of different ways, finding people on the inside of, say, a government or for-profit organisation who are quietly going about their business but also doing their bit to pull the levers for change is a very important role. As we go through these, you might be thinking, oh, where do I fit? Which one am I most like in this scenario? Miriam is an inviter. Miriam had the gift to invite Pharaoh's daughter in, to say, oh, hey, why don't you come be part of our little conspiracy? Why don't you join in solidarity with the other women in this story in order to be part of changing this unjust situation that's going on? Miriam invited powerful people to defect. It's a great feeling when you manage to get someone to come over. Not because, remember, in the cause of making holy change or in the cause of non-violent direct action, we're not just looking to win, but we're looking to win people over. So when someone in a position of power and authority you don't just beat them, but you also win their heart, change their heart at the same time, that's a powerful, powerful moment. And Miriam has this role in making connections. These days we call it networking, a very important part of the process of holy change making. And finally, Pharaoh's daughter uses her position as a princess. She has intrinsic authority and intrinsic respect and dignity, so she uses that position in order to save a life, in order to make a difference. And she uses her position to prioritise those who experience oppression, and she keeps faith and solidarity with those who are vulnerable and marginalised. In your life, you may have come across people who have power, who have authority, who have status, who are senior somewhere in the hierarchy, and use that position for good and for holiness. And so these are some of the roles in holy change-making that we find in this narrative in the scriptures. This is the first recorded instance of civil disobedience in the scriptures. And we meet these amazing, powerful women who are saving the lives of boys. It's the boys who are at risk, and it'll be the little boy in particular, Moses, who goes on to become the great hero. He leads them through, and he confronts Pharaoh, and the manna from heaven, and all of that. That's all Moses. He's portrayed as the hero of the story, but there is no story without the midwives of life and liberation. This is a verse from a hymn. I'll dig out the reference, but one of the key things I think about being a saint, about being one of the people of God, is that, as you know, we don't just all come with the same gifts. We bring different gifts. And that within the sort of holy change-making or holy troublemaking path, we're not all doing the same thing all of the time. Not everyone's signing and putting petitions together. Not everyone is going to protests and rallies. Not everyone's writing letters. Not everyone's caring directly for people who are affected. Everyone has a different role to play. Some march with events to turn them God's way. Some need to withdraw, the better to pray. Some carry the gospel through fire and through flood. The world is their parish. Their purpose is God. And you'll know that the world is their parish. The world is my parish. That's what John Wesley said, one of the great heroes of our faith. What am I doing right now? I often ask myself this question. One of the things I'm working on right now is a union. It's new. We're into our second year now. It's national, so we cover the whole of Australia. It's interfaith, which means that membership is open to people who work, who are faith workers, who work to share and strengthen faith of any faith tradition. It's predominantly Christians at the moment, but we are open to imams and rabbis and, I don't know, the leaders of a witch's coven, I guess, if they want to join. It's also a good protection for us, because people say, oh, that's not very Christian of you. And we say, oh, we're not a Christian organization. Problem solved. We don't. And Faith Workers Alliance grew out of a conversation, one of those conversations from someone who was a bit of a Miriam, someone who was a bit of a recruiter. I got a phone call from a former student of mine. I was a school chaplain back in the day. And one of my things I did was coached the year 10 debating team. And one of the speakers, one of the debaters from the year 10 debating team, had been to uni and studied politics and then went to work for a union. And I don't know if you know much about the union movement, but everyone starts on reception. So it doesn't matter how many skills, degrees, whatever you are, everyone's just like, no, you can start on reception. So he was on reception, a bit bored. But in his boredom at reception, he discovered that the partner union in the UK had a branch, the faith workers branch, for faith workers, for members of the clergy, particularly Church of England clergy. And just completely out of the blue, he sent me a message on Facebook, as was the custom at the time, and he said, "Oh, Father Chris, you're the only priest I know." Good. I was just wondering, why isn't there a union for faith workers in Australia? And I, rather glibly, said, "Because I haven't started it yet." The arrogance required is astounding. And he said, "What if I put some heads together? What if we got some people in a room and started to have this conversation?" I said, "Go for it, Caleb." I said, "Get your, you know, you're 22 years old and you've got nothing else to do. Get on with it." So he did. He got some heads in a room from the union movement. I got some heads in the room from the faith worker side of things. And we began actually several years of discussions, really, of what this thing would look like, what our values would be. And in particular, did we want to join up or find a way to join up with an existing union? The end result was not that we didn't want to join up with an existing union, but no union wanted us. Now, if you think about what else has been going on in the public eye around faith workers and clergy over, say, the last 5 years, and the kind of scandals and the kind of, you know, the perceptions that people might have of people who work professionally to share and strengthen faith, you might start to realise, why wouldn't an enormous union want to take a risk and bring in a bunch of people who are going to bring more risk into their organisation? So with the support of a range of existing unions and the ACTU, we went out on our own. We started our own, got our own thing, our own management committee, our own constitution. And away we go. And my function now, initially I was the chair of the management committee, I'm now executive officer, so I work the princely number of hours of 8 per week for Faith Workers Alliance. And people often ask me this question: why do faith workers need a union? Now, I understand in this congregation you don't employ someone directly at the moment to do faith work. It's a shared system, and I think that's highly commendable and a little bit communist of you. But many churches have people who are in paid professional roles. And I can tell you, having been in professional ministry for more than 20 years, that the safety for those workers is very poor. That the risks that those workers face is very high, that the likelihood and prevalence of burnout is extremely high, and that there are people who, when they leave faith work, don't just leave the work, they also leave the faith. And in fact, huge numbers of people out there who have a horror story to tell, that they were inspired and enthusiastic and willing to give up and sacrifice a great deal to go and work in a faith work setting, and a matter of years later have not only abandoned that work but have also abandoned any sense of faith in God and certainly any sense of faith in the church as an organisation. That's what I want to change. And this is how I and 100 others are trying to do that. And this is our flyer. I can give you flyers if you want them, but it's all up here. We advocate for safe and fair workplaces, and particularly psychosocially safe, that's the new phrase, and remind churches and church institutions that they also have to abide by the law. Shocking. Yeah, like churches have to obey the law of the land. Weird. And we support our members in times of crisis and challenge, and I average about one a week at the moment of someone who calls and goes, "It's all just falling apart. There's a huge conflict, or there's this, or there's a complaint, or whatever." Sometimes the complaint is justified and they've done the wrong thing and they've been an idiot. Most faith workers are idiots. I say that. I'm right? I'm one. And you know, make dumb decisions all the time. But the question isn't whether they did the wrong thing, but how the process unfolds, how it's handled. Because as you know, in your workplace or in your community, if you did the wrong thing, you expect to be held to account for that. But the way that is done is often very destructive. And so we exist. That's our first bit of defiance. Existence, thank you. Existence is resistance, we say. We exist. We've had a few little wins. I can't tell you about them. because they're all confidential, but we've had them. We've had some losses too. We've tried to help people and it hasn't worked. But we have also, even in our short life now, in a year and a half, called to account church and faith-based institutions to say that the way that you treat people when things are going badly has to also reflect your values. We can't assume that it will always be about when things are going well. There was literally just last week some research that was produced not by Faith Workers Alliance, but by a group called Uphold. I have to say Uphold come from a theological perspective that I struggle with, from a very conservative perspective, where they would see that men primarily would be the ones who only who can have leadership roles. And they're very much focused around the Anglicans in Sydney and Moore College, that some of you might know that scene. But there's a group there. I love this group because what they're doing is collecting data. Because people will always say, oh, there's narratives, there's stories to tell. But they've gone, no. Let's collect actual numbers. So they did a survey where they interviewed faith workers, particularly in subordinate roles. So not the boss, so not like the senior minister, but the assistant minister, the family minister, the children's minister, the women's minister, because they're that kind of churches. And they asked all of them to report in, and 64% out of, I think they had 180 responses, 64% said that they'd experienced bullying inside a church setting. 46% said that they'd experienced mental or emotional abuse. 30% said they'd experienced spiritual abuse, which is basically a misuse of power for spiritual purposes. And 36% had experienced unfair dismissal. That means it's harsh, unreasonable, or unfair. That's the church, the institutional church. This is one bit of the institutional church. And your gut response might be a bit like my first response was, and go, oh, well, that's just the conservative evangelicals. That wouldn't happen in other parts of the church. Everywhere. These numbers are repeating themselves throughout the institutional church. And then when we look at the outcomes of the Royal Commission into institutional responses into child abuse, we see that what has happened is the institutional church has provided a useful and convenient vessel in which abusers can flourish. And largely, not completely, but largely, the abuse of children is controlled. You know, it might not be at an end, but it's certainly been greatly diminished, and the opportunity for that has been reduced. But the opportunity for other forms of abuse is still flourishing in institutional Christian settings. Now, I'm not here to depress you today, or to... I'm also not here to commend you for being basically an independent church and away from institutional church settings, because be assured, independent churches have their own issues as well. But what we are trying to do as a union for faith workers is to support faith workers in their setting, to have a voice, to be able to respond to situations that are unsafe or where they're being treated unfairly. We aim to be a voice which represents faith workers, both to their own organisations and more broadly in society. So we're slowly building up our networks of influence so that we can advocate on behalf of faith workers. And we aim to empower faith workers so they know how can they be safe? What are their rights? What are their obligations? What are the boundaries in which they work? How can they be trained more effectively and supported more effectively in their work? But all of this work isn't just because I'm a filthy left winger. Let me emphasise, I am a filthy left winger, right? Let me be quite clear about that. I'm a card-carrying socialist. But that's not why we're doing this work. And it's also not because we want to undermine or destabilise institutional churches, even though some of what we do will have that result. Fundamentally, the reason that we are working on Faith Workers Alliance as the new national interfaith union is so that there can be more and better midwives of life and liberation. Because the impact of churches in communities is enormous. The impact of all faith organisations in communities is enormous. But the second, an unsafe, conflictual, dangerous, bullying, spiritually abusive scenario appears in a church, the church moves from being for the common good and starts to be destructive for everyone involved. It moves from being a net contributor to the good of society and community and the kingdom, and it starts to be a net withdrawer of goodness from the community and from the kingdom. The safer our faith workers are, the better supported and encouraged they are, and the more fulfilled they are in their work, the better it is for the whole of our communities. And so that's where it comes full circle for me, because people say to me, how is it that you can be an Anglican priest and you've made all these vows and promises and you know, you're part of that organization and involved in this enterprise to start a new union? And fundamentally, it comes back to the idea of the parish system for me, which I believe in, which is that if you're in our household, then you're our problem. You're our responsibility. We have to look after you. And I believe that the church doesn't exist for its own benefit, but for the benefit of those who are not part of it or not yet part of it. Our responsibility is for those beyond ourselves. And so to have a strong and vital group of faith workers in this country who are protected and empowered benefits everyone. That's what we're trying to do. And thank you for being willing to hear about that.
Just before I pass this around, Chris, I had an observation in the early part of your talk.
Sure.
You talked about how difficult it would be to hide a baby. it made me think of those Jewish families in World War II.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you.
Comrade. Is this working?
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay. Some years ago I started working on a PhD and I was looking at Jesus' teachings and whether what teachings he had about hierarchical churches. And after a year's study, and that was full-time study, I gave up the PhD for reasons which weren't to do with the research. I was really enjoying that. I just couldn't stand the academic hoops that were I had to jump through. In all that time, I came across one verse which I think could be misinterpreted to suggest that Jesus thought that hierarchies were a good idea, and dozens upon dozens of verses where he says, you have to be servants. You have one teacher, you are all brothers. You know, and I had a paid teaching role here, part-time, for 7 years. At the end, I resigned, and I still have a even more part-time teaching role. Not being paid is wonderful. Just being part of the community and standing up occasionally and doing my thing and knowing that they can stop me anytime they like is wonderful. Yeah, it seems to me that so much of this is actually about ordination. I don't think there's a problem with ordination of women or gay people. I think there's a problem with ordination at all when you look at Jesus' teachings.
Spoken like a true Protestant. Yeah, and look, one of the ways I tend to think about hierarchy in the church is that, this helps me, I don't know if it'll help you, is that in the tradition I come from, ordination is at baptism, so everyone is ordained to ministry via baptism, and then some are required to serve to a greater extent. So in my tradition, that's deacons and priests and bishops. And theoretically, bishops are the ones who have been given the greatest burden of service, who have to sacrifice the most in order to enable the mission to flourish. And the way we acknowledge that in the Anglican Church is by paying them 2.5 times as much as the priests, right? And so there's not just a question around ordination as a concept, whether we should have orders of ministry, but then what we do with them once we've got them. The Archbishop of Perth, who is a very nice lady, lives in a palace, like it's literally like a huge mansion. How can you live like that? And then also go, oh, but my primary responsibility is service. So I think, but I take your point. Yeah, thank you.
I'm a filthy left winger and a card carrying member of the ALP, and I wear the badge on my coat. One of the things I'm wondering is whether when you advertise the Faith Workers Alliance, which you could call a union, you meet much resistance among faith workers, because experience I had a number of years ago now, a friend of mine who was then a Presbyterian minister became rightly concerned about the poor working conditions of his fellow ministers, particularly the pay. And my job was to contact them and ask them what they were paid and whether they thought they should get paid more. And I received a lot of... We do this it's a calling. We're not in it for the money. And there was real resistance to anybody who might want to actually improve their conditions.
Yeah, so the word condition has multiple meanings, and one of them is around conditioning people about what's normal. And so one of the things that we are noticing, it's not new, but something that's really come to our attention, is that the training of faith workers is a form of conditioning in which you're conditioned into the idea that that unsafe and unreasonable working conditions should be normal and should be accepted. And if you don't accept the conditioning, you are moved out of the training program. And we also see it in people's early years in professional ministry. If they push against the conditioning that you should accept unsafe, unfair, unjust conditions, again, you're rapidly moved out, usually through bullying, but through other mechanisms. So, yes, when I hear people say that, I don't say to them, I see you've been conditioned well by the faith organisation that you're part of. I simply note that we are not hunting people who don't want to join. If there's no point trying to get someone to join something who's not interested. But what we are finding is that there are a significant proportion who do want to join or who are willing to join when they're asked. But as you'll know from evangelism, the best form is peer-to-peer connection. We can do all the advertising in the world, won't make a difference. But when a friend or colleague says, hey, have you thought about joining? That's when people usually join up. Yeah.
Yeah, as a preacher's kid, I can identify. My father just refused to shift into the house they offered him, last parish. Anyway. And I was thinking quirkily of, industrial action taken by faith workers. I can just imagine the story on Channel 7 News. Australia's been thrown into chaos by lack of services. But the thing I was really... Sorry, that was just my sense of humour. But what I was wondering about was... many instances of abuse I've heard of have been perpetrated, if that's the word, by actions of unpaid volunteers within churches, the laity or just the church membership ganging up on someone, basically. How do we hold those? Because normally the unions are to protect people from the owners, yep. But the owners in this case are people who aren't getting paid, who don't actually have a stake in the same way, industrial. So what do you reckon?
Yeah, look.
Sorry? Oh, yeah, sorry. I just mean that, how do you take it to the congregation who are abusing a worker?
There are some pragmatic answers to that question. One of them is the new work health and safety laws in Western Australia do not make any distinction between paid and unpaid workers. So an unpaid worker can still be held liable for their behaviour. For example, and there are lots of other, legal frameworks around the place. The cold reality, too, is that you talked about industrial action. We're never going to go on strike. Like, it's just not going to happen. But I'm growing towards the point of kind of blackbanning certain churches and saying, actually, we ban our members from working there, which would be a provocative act. But then it may get to the point where that's required. Where we just say no. Well, you can keep looking for someone to come and work there, but we're putting a label on you that says this is an unsafe workplace, and we can't recommend that anyone work there. One of the things for us is that this is a 10 and 20 and 30 year project in its early stages, but we will see how it evolves. But some of it's just about having awareness. So a lot of faith workers aren't well equipped in family systems, and churches are family systems, and so they go in thinking that it'll be like a workplace, or it'll be professional. Churches are not professional generally, And often get a rude shock, particularly if they've come from another sector. They've come from education or from healthcare or from business, and they suddenly are in the church and go, oh, it doesn't work like any of those things at all. Every other rule is out the window. So there are some legal avenues, but actually it's the using the levers and the influence, I think, will be the more likely pathway for us. Yeah.
Chris, Claire grew up in a clergy household, and I remember her talking about the fact that it was a 24/7 job. Yeah. And I'm just reflecting that, I guess, similar to the idea of midwives. You know, when the babies get coming, you know, you just got to go. There's no stopping. And I guess the idea that when there's a crisis in the parish or whatever, then the clergy has to turn up. So similar to a lot of caring professions which don't operate 9 to 5, how do you manage that?
Yeah, sure.
Without being uncaring.
Maybe. Yeah, absolutely. There's a great book called If You Meet George Herbert on the Road, Kill Him. So George Herbert was created this iconic picture of the English rural vicar. You know, it's like the vicar that you see in TV shows who toddles around town and says hello and has cups of tea with the old ladies and is available on call to go to someone's home when they're dying at 2 a.m. And the idyllic rural vicar has a relatively low workload in a functional sense. So he prays, he prepares his sermon, and he chats with people. A relatively low workload in order to be available at the times of crisis. So you've got like a reserves of energy. But the modern faith worker has a vast workload because they are administrative management personnel. They're volunteer manager, event manager, communications manager, child protection and screening manager. They're chairing meetings and there's projects and there's this, and you've got to deliver. There's, you know, why are there more people coming to church? Why are the finances suffering? No. So the workload is so huge that there are no reserves left in order to respond in times of crisis. So I guess it is 24/7, but what's happened is the typical faith worker is doing two jobs. They're doing a full-time management job, and they're also doing a full-time spiritual, you know, guide job. And that's why we have such massive rates of burnout and breakdown. And I don't know the precise solution to that, but part of it is just naming that reality. Yeah.
Chris,
yeah?
Could you just tell us a little bit about that frightfully evil program on the radio ABC you used to run, or is it still going?
Oh, every second Monday, this coming Monday, 6 p.m. ABC 720, Holy Heretics. You can hear me talk to Jeff Hutchison about whatever pops into anybody's head. Oh, yeah, still there. Yeah, once a fortnight. Yeah, 6 p.m. Yeah.
Two thoughts I had while you were talking about the dual roles of the pastor. I think part of the problem is that one of those roles used to be held by the pastor's wife, and she used to do all of the unseen admin work, and now pastor's wives have their own jobs, or aren't married, or whatever. My other question was just around unintended consequences. So we're talking about professionalising a profession that has had very loose kind of professional standards, which has been of benefit and problems, but I guess from my own perspective, watching professionalisation of employment situations, there's always something that you lose. Yeah. And how do we manage that loss? How do we hold that unintended consequence of loss of relationship, loss of, you know, boundaries are wonderful things, but unboundary people are always there. And so how do you hold that?
Yeah, it's really a question of cake. Do you want to have your cake and eat it too? There are in the world, not many, but there are still faith work or clergy positions which are sinecures, which are fully funded by some historic endowment or trust, or you know, where you don't have to earn your living, where somewhere out there's money in order to pay. And when you meet, in the world of faith work, those jobs are like the Holy Grail, like the dream. Like, imagine a position where I could just be the pastor, the preacher, the teacher, the carer, the community connector, and not also have to be the property manager, the fundraiser, the event organizer, and all of that. People dream of that. And I think there's probably something to be said for separating out the reality that the modern church, this one's a bit different, but even this one, you have compliance obligations, right? Someone's still got to, you know, book the hall and pay the bills and whatever has to be done. To separate out the compliance obligations, if you like, or the regulatory requirements from the grassroots work. And I think in institutional churches which do that are finding it a bit easier. But currently, that's my best guess on how to effect that kind of change, because, as you say, a lot of people are called to a ministry, they don't apply for a job, and so, but then they find themselves having been called to a ministry, actually being given a massive job to do, and go, but this isn't what I was called to, this is isn't what I was trained for, this isn't what I wanted to do, and yet here I am running the Heritage Building Project because there's no one else to do it, you know. The buck stops with me. So yeah, major big level systemic thinking in for the large faith organizations, I think, is inevitable. Yeah.
Hi, Chris. So as a previous member of the compliance committee, so yes, that's how we manage it here. We've got one group of eldership that look after spiritual directions, community, the other one, the PNF committee, which look after compliance. One of the things that I noticed as a treasurer, and we were looking to employ people, the distinct lack of pro forma employment contracts, terms and conditions. As an organisation, we were trying to comply, trying to find ways, and it was hard. Yeah. It was hard trying to find that. So as an organisation, if you could provide pro forma templates for churches or standard agreed terms and conditions for employment, as someone who's looking to comply, that would be great.
That's it. Thank you. How long have you got? But one of the key things there is that most, with the exception of a few, most faith organisations, so churches, claim that their clergy are not employees. They are office holders and do not have... So that means there's no employment rights, no unfair dismissal, no. Yeah. Oh, did you not know this? So this is what's given rise to Faith Workers Alliance, is the fact that there are court cases, there are legal precedent, the High Court has ruled on it a long time ago, Fair Work has ruled... So although there was a recent situation where that's changed. But broadly, the consensus in Australia is that most of the clergy are not deemed to be employees, which means that we are like Uber, right? Right? The churches, I mean, perceive themselves to be like Uber in that, you know, we've got this non-employment relationship with people, which is not, it's complete nonsense when you're paying superannuation and tax and there's job descriptions and all of that. So that's the reason that those pro formas don't exist, is because that would require an admission that these people are employees. But over time, we will be working towards first guidelines and ultimately an award for faith workers, hopefully in my lifetime. And yeah, and so that will provide hopefully some structure there. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It absolutely will be. Yeah.
The second question that I have, just as a point of curiosity, is I'm just wondering where the boundaries of your sense of a faith worker is. Is it a volunteer? Is it a chaplain, or is it just the people standing up, or is it the administration people? So,
thank you for asking. And this is all outlined on our website, but there are two thresholds. The first threshold is that you work to share and strengthen faith. You don't need to be paid to do that. So, volunteers are eligible for membership if they want to join. Also, retired people and students if they are eligible. But the second criteria is that you have to work for a faith organisation, that is an organisation which is established for the purposes of sharing and strengthening faith. So if you are a chaplain who works for the Department of Health, you meet the first criteria, but not the second criteria. If you are a chaplain in the if you are the secretary, the receptionist for a church, you meet the second criteria, but not the first criteria. So we have had to gently direct people to other unions because they haven't met our criteria. That's also because, this will shock you, the union movement has a strong sense of demarcation. I know this is news, so it's very important that we are not signing up members who are eligible for other unions. So, yeah, basically, but, yeah, if someone says, I work to share and strengthen faith, and I do that work inside a faith organisation that shares and strengthens faith, we don't query that. It's only if they give us information that says they might not be eligible, then we're like, thanks but no thanks, go join the ASU or some other very hard-working union. Yeah.
Wow. I have a question.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. When we were young, we always thought, for the ministry work is by calling by God.
Yeah.
Not for your job or anything like that. So by calling by God, you have to sacrifice your life. Mm. So when church have ministers and pay the payments, when they don't have enough thing, ministers can't ask pay rise or anything. And how could you treat ministers like that these days? Because in old time, Paul had his own job,
yeah,
and support himself. You can do it like that all, yeah, the time. We were taught like that. How could we these days to apply that kind, yeah, of calling by the God?
I can tell you that amongst our members, hardly anyone talks about pay. That's the least concern. Even when I look at what someone's being paid and go, are you kidding me? The member themselves is rarely concerned about that. It's usually the conditions that that's the safety is usually the biggest issue. That said, we have uncovered multiple instances of faith workers in Australia who are being paid less than the minimum wage, which is illegal, right? And I would think, as a church, if you were paying someone less than the minimum wage, wouldn't you be embarrassed by that? Wouldn't you be ashamed? Say, oh, we've got this person working for us full time, but we pay them less than they could earn literally doing anything else. So I think the labourer is worthy of their hire, and so I do not believe that faith workers should be paid megabucks. Not remotely, and I would never be advocating for that. And when I was a faith worker, I did not get paid megabucks, and I still don't. But I think it should be enough that you can live a reasonable life, and also that it's enough that in retirement you can live a reasonable life. And if it's the case that someone's going to be working two jobs or working in order to earn money in order to do ministry, I commend that. In fact, I do that now. So I do other work, and that enables me to do other bits of ministry in an unpaid way. But I think that needs to be clear. Everyone needs to understand that that's what's going on, and that it's either written down or that there's a clear understanding around that. Because what we do see is a lot of exploitation, and a lot of exploitation of young people. And in some settings, exploitations are really young people, like 18 and 19-year-olds who are working 70 hours a week for next to nothing in order to keep the church machinery going. That we as a church, we can't be exploiting people in order to keep our own operations going. I'm happy for people to do 70 hours a week if they're feeding the poor, or if they're serving people who are extremely vulnerable and marginalised, but not to stack the chairs and do the PowerPoint slides and the other bits and pieces. So thank you so much for plying me with questions. Thank you.